If you're thinking about getting into cooking, do your research on where you're going to work. Be committed. Practice a lot at home. And, you know, cook for people. If you love cooking and you're passionate about it, you need to find that bridge of loving cooking but also having a career, because they're two very different things. So you've got to have a bridge that connects the two. And if you can find that, you're half a chance.
We continue to talk staffing on Dirty Linen this week, and we are heading to Brisbane, Queensland, to talk to Shannon Kellum. Shannon has a few pots on the boil. He is the owner and chef of Montrachet, a fine dining French restaurant. He recently set up Lumiere Culinary Studio, and he also has the Needery Pastry Kitchen and School there as well. Shannon, welcome to Dirty Linen.
Thank you very much. Pleasure to be here.
It's really great to have you on the show, and you have a wealth of experience in the industry. I might just get you to just introduce yourself so the listeners know a little bit more about you and where you're coming from.
Yeah, sure. I'm a Brizzy boy, born in Bundaberg actually, but grew up in a real working class suburb on the north side of Brisbane. Come from a tradie family. My father's a diesel fitter. My mother's a cleaner. All my brothers are mechanics. I was the youngest, so I was sort of always given the worst of the worst jobs in the mechanical workshop. So I think that's what put me off it. And I really always into things that were more artistic and a bit more refined. So at the age of 16, I landed on the doors of a kitchen called Raphael's, which was a three-hat restaurant back in the day, still the only restaurant in the history of the guide to hold that score as a BYO with no points for a wine list, and worked with a fantastic chef called Rick Stephen, who's still my mentor today, 28 years down the track. And then after there, started a lot of competing domestically. And then after my first five-year apprenticeship as pastry, went to do my chef's apprenticeship at the Sheraton. So I went from small family restaurant to large hotel to learn all those management systems and all the different outlets. And then continued my competing days and competed for about 20 years all up, doing two Culinary Olympics in the Australian senior national team in Germany, Global Chef World Final in Norway, Dubai World Cup, and also the Bocuse d'Or two times, 2013 and 2015, just to name a few of the notable ones. But certainly been around and put myself through a lot, but wouldn't change a day of it.
That is just such an incredible summary of, I mean, it doesn't even bring us up to date, but just of your passion for the industry and your longevity in the career. And even the way you start that story talking about, you know, Rick, who's still your mentor, you obviously have such a respect for the craft and for the industry that's built up around it.
Yeah, I think, well, you know, I was always a bit of a history buff as well. It really interested me. So when I started my apprenticeship, I was a real student to the craft, and I was really interested in where is all of this profession come from before me. And it was sort of something that was really ingrained in me that I have to really learn a lot about that and be very strong with all those things so I can have better tools in the shed, I guess, on how to develop myself and how to pivot and change as certainly times would change and trends would change throughout the career. And I guess looking back at my chef, Rick, who's now based in Singapore, he's actually the chef for Singapore Airlines globally and has a team of about 5,800 chefs. I guess one thing when I look at him and also a lot of mentors I've had around the world who are older than me, the ones that have continued to always reinvent themselves and develop themselves and keep up with the trends and the times. I think that's really important if you're a career chef.
I wonder what it's like to be the head chef of an international airline at the moment.
Well, it'd be hard going. Look, I suppose in an organisation like that, it'd be demanding, but you also would have got a lot of support structure around you as well, and they certainly would keep themselves busy. You normally find, you know, big kitchens with big systems like that would also be doing things locally for the local community as well. So, yeah, I'm sure like everybody, no matter what the size you are, I'm sure they're doing things they never used to do before until things start opening up more for them as well.
Yeah, absolutely. So, Shannon, I think you know, I've got you on the show because I know you're really passionate about training. And, you know, as we talk about staffing, obviously people who've got that passion for the industry and the knowledge and how to perform in it, and of course that continuing thirst for knowledge is so crucial to getting and retaining staff. Can you just, I suppose, just give us a little sense of what you think of the place of training in the industry today?
Well, I think compared to years gone by, I think there's a huge importance on people to be able to do the training in-house themselves. And I know some people, some large organisations in the industry, large companies like, you know, if you look at the staff, for example, and large groups like that, they certainly do a lot of work with the in-house training. It depends on what platform you're on. So, you know, if it's large catering compared to something that's more of an artisan approach, I think the more, like everything, or like a lot of industries these days, I feel that, I guess, well, the word artisan, I didn't even know what that was until several years ago. But I guess if you're going to make everything, from a classical way, and all facets of the kitchen, from patisserie to butchery to working with fish and working with vegetables, I guess it can be difficult to find the right environment to be able to learn all of those things. And I guess also ingraining people that are starting their careers in cooking, it's really important to get the message into them that you'll only go to a certain point where you then become your best teacher. And that's something that was taught to me by my chef at a very young age. And so I really understood that I'm only going to learn so much from different chefs, from different kitchens around the place. And also, I guess you get to a certain stage from a cooking experience, cooking ability, where you're really just starting to learn more about the philosophies of other chefs. And somewhere along the line, you need to work out what's your philosophy. But if you don't have the tools in the shed, you're going to be really limited on what that philosophy might be. And also, then everything else comes in many layers below that, working with producers and suppliers and working the seasons and the allocations and how to communicate with people if you're going to put something on a menu, the budgeting, making sure that the business is viable, all of those things. You're only ever going to learn a certain amount off everybody. Sooner or later, you need to teach yourself those things.
I mean, what do you think of the state of training at the moment? Do you think things are okay?
No, I think it's really poor, really poor. Yeah, I think, people, one thing, you know, when I was younger and I'd listen to older chefs talk, I always said to myself, I never want to be one of those older chefs that have a grim look on things and, you know, and a naysayers and doubt the younger generation coming through and all that kind of thing, because there's many fantastic young chefs coming through. But I think the job of a chef has changed. And I think the understanding of the word, what does a chef mean, has slightly changed as well. When I was younger, we were taught that there's only one chef in the kitchen and everybody else is a cook. That's certainly changed over the years as well. Chef at the end of the day means you're the chef, you're the chief, you're the boss, and you have to be the boss of everything, mentoring young people to, like I said, the administration, the budgeting, having your sergeants underneath you, like your sous chefs and whatnot, that are helping to train and delegate things out amongst the team. But I think people really need to focus for a longer period of time on just being a really good cook, and then sort of working out where they want their career to go. So the training is very different now. But in saying that, it's sort of been left behind because there's still big venues to open. There's still big restaurants to open. There's still restaurant groups and hotel groups. And so here in Australia, I sort of sometimes scratch my head wondering, well, where's the next crop of those career chefs coming from? Because the training now has all been dumbed down, again, like a lot of things, not just in our industry, but everywhere. But the service is still in demand. So the training really hasn't, I guess, one or the other hasn't really kept up with each other, or one or the other has been left behind. I guess there's two different ways of looking at it.
I mean, there are so many different aspects to what you're saying. One thing that I suppose there's a few things that come to my mind. One is that people perhaps are more impatient just to get into the workforce and just do stuff. They feel like they just should be given a go. And the other one is that pressure. Yeah, there are so many more venues now than there were, relative to population. It's just there's obviously restaurants, you know, everywhere on every corner at the bottom of every development. There's a lot more larger venues for events and all that kind of stuff. So there is that demand to pull people out of training and to fast track them into the industry.
It's very true. And I think you hit the nail. I think you somewhat hit the nail on the head there, talking about, the volume of venues within the industry and, the short supply of people that are being trained, but also more importantly, people wanting things in the now. You know, when I was younger, you gauged your, how hard you worked. You sort of gauged on if that was warranted by what you were learning, and that was your wealth. And it was always drilled into me that until you've done this for a good 10 to 12 years, that's when you'll sort of become your own chef and or have the tools in the shed behind you to then go and run a kitchen for someone, or at, you know, even with the most demand would be running your own kitchen. So I guess in that, 10-year period, you were trying to learn all different areas of the industry. So then you could make your own mind up, okay, what sort of chef do I want to be, and what venue do I want to run, and how do I see myself as a leader? Whereas after 3 years of doing an apprenticeship now, and getting a certificate that's worth the same as my certificate, I guess it doesn't quite add up, unless, like some other industries, things have changed and we don't need to work like that anymore. But that's where it's, I guess, where I was saying earlier, something's been left behind, because we do still need to work like the way we were trained many years ago. People forget that we work with fresh ingredients, and that's going in someone's body. So if you aren't strong on kitchen management, hygiene practices, training, or your stock rotation, just kitchen management from top to bottom before you even worry about the financials, then what sort of standard are we setting ourselves? And for someone who's represented Australia on the toughest stages in the world for chefs, the reason, one of the key reasons that drives you to do that is you're representing your nation to the world on what standard of chefs come from our country. And that's, and again, that was something that was instilled to me at a very young age, the importance of that. Because when you travel, one of the first questions you ask people is, what was the food like? So, tourism is very important to Australia, and our showcasing our producers, having that platform in kitchens through high-end premium dining rooms, that's something that's really, really important. And there's many great venues in Australia that do a fantastic job of showcasing that, but it is limited. When you look at the size of our country, it is limited, and it's only going to get more limited because of the training.
There's obviously such a sense of pride in what you do, the way that you want to use it to showcase not just your skills, but, the bounty of the country that you live in. So there's so much in that. And what springs to my mind is, like, I can't help but think that perhaps there's something in the increase in restaurants that aren't owned by people that have come up in the industry. This restaurant's becoming more of a business. Like, do you think there's something to that?
Oh, absolutely. And, when I came back from my second Bocuse d'Or, that was my last competition, and I hung up the boots after that, and I came back to Brizzy in early 2015 and took over a really iconic restaurant called Montrachet, and it was a real institution. And, I could have easily just opened a new restaurant like most people would, but I'm one about challenges, and I'm also one about taking something that's already great, has a great clientele base, and having a restaurant that will go the 25, 30 years, because that used to be a normal thing. And that's one of the reasons why my wife and I decided to take on Montrachet, not take something that's just a new restaurant. For me, that was an easier option. I guess in the answer to your question, that it has changed the dynamic of our industry or our profession, because there are less chef owners now. So, and I mean real chef owners, where it is just yourself and or your partner, and there's no investors, there's no one else involved, and you've got skin in the game, and it's all on you. So I think that goes a long way to change what has changed our industry for sure. When I came back, talking to people in the media would say, oh, you must be so excited to be back in Brisbane now with your own restaurant. Things have progressed so much and things have changed so much. And for me personally, we've gone backwards in some regard, in some regard, we've gone forward as well. We've certainly done a better job of showcasing our native cuisine than what we were in the early 90s and late 80s when we made the big mistake of calling it bush tucker. So you're never going to sell anything that's refined or a premium offering calling it bush tucker, because that was the big push in the early 90s. And I think Australia's young Australian chefs have rolled on the back of looking at people like Rene Redzepi, for example, that really champion Scandinavian food. But they done in a real professional way. So I think Australia still has a huge amount of untapped potential to go down that path. But without a lot of proper chef owners, I'm not sure. Because when you think about it, a lot of the direction and the philosophy, as I spoke about earlier, comes from the chef. And that's built around the team. Same with the maitre d' or the restaurant manager, and certainly the sommelier. They are building the culture in sync with the chef, and that's how it all goes. So if you're a restaurant owner and you've got your own ideas, how's it ever going to work for the long term? The chef will always work hard and work above and beyond what is needed if they've got the skill behind them to produce something great. But is it going to be around for 10, 12, 15, 20 years when it's not theirs? No, it won't be. So when the chef leaves the kitchen, well, the brigade leaves with him, or they disband and they go to other kitchens. And then the restaurant owner is left scratching his head and saying, well, how am I going to replace that chef? And they can't. So if you look at the cycle of great restaurants in Australia at the moment, and this is in general, I would say they're around 3 to 5 year lifespan. So that's very different to when I was young, when all the great restaurants, the majority of the hatted restaurants that I knew of when I was young, they were nearly all chef owners. They weren't going anywhere. You can't just pack up and go. You've made that commitment, and that restaurant is like your dining room. It's like your home. So it's a big call if you're going to shut it down and move on. So those sort of things tended to be around for the long term.
Yeah, I mean, so what I would love you to do now, Shannon, is to talk about the way that you've structured Montrachet in concert with Lumiere and the production kitchen, because as much as you hark back to, you know, the glory days of the chef owner paradigm, it's actually really hard to do that these days with, you know, people working, you know, sticking to not doing so over the hours, and with, you know, with a changed kitchen culture. So tell us how you actually make that stack up.
Yeah, sure. I guess if we're going to change, you need to draw on your experience to work out how to change. I know I mentioned in the past that, I've personally, and not that it had much to do with me, but personally I was really frustrated to see a lot of chefs down south that are in the media really cop it for, you know, for some of the overworking the staff and whatnot, because that's certainly one side of the story. Of course it is. Totally don't disagree with it in this day and age or in any day and age. But what's the solution? So if it's a real issue and we need to think of a solution, well, unless the patrons want to spend at least double of what they're paying now to go to a restaurant, so everyone would have two brigades, one to do lunch, one to do dinner, that's an easy solution. But anyone I talk to doesn't want to do that, doesn't want to pay the extra. So then what's the solution? So I guess for myself personally, I tried to really think about how am I going to change the way in what we work and still produce what we can produce, where you make everything from scratch. And I guess seeing things around the world and seeing things in big operations, being involved in small chef-owner restaurants, you have a good, I guess you've got a good pool of knowledge to pull from and how to make it better. So in our operation, we have a big central kitchen that's 1,000 square metres. We have a small family-owned restaurant. We've got a boat. We've got events business. We've got pastry shops. We've got all the facets of our industry all under our banner. So with a central kitchen, it's hard to think about how that's going to draw enough revenue to run that big facility. It's got to wear many different hats. So in our operation, it suited, I guess, well, that's how that idea came about, was that this central kitchen can back up a restaurant like Montrachet for a lot of the arduous and time-consuming mise en place. Things like stocks and consommés and slow-cooked braised items and farinaceous items, all the homemade pastas, for example, and of course all the pastry, all the artisan breads, all the petit four, all those things come out of our central kitchen made by experts, and they don't need to worry about service. So all that work was taken out of the old Montrachet. And so we do now, we still have the space restriction, of course, for COVID, but we do some different turns that we came up, start service a little bit earlier, we can extra turn in the middle of service. So we do about the same amount of numbers we used to do pre-COVID, not far off it. And we have five chefs. We used to have seven or eight sometimes on site, and we do about 60% of the hours that we used to work. So this central kitchen idea is really, really worked well. People could possibly go into the central kitchen idea and offer that service to a lot of restaurants and make customized recipes and customized preparation, for example. I think the central kitchen is a good solution for moving forward.
Is it kind of a bummer, though?
Yes. Look, at the end of the day, like I said earlier, you've got to learn to change and change with the trends and change with the expectations and change with how people see life and want to work today. If not, you'll get left behind. So, but at the same stage, and I guess what you're steering me towards, yes, I do have my personal opinion on it. I think what's difficult here, and I know chefs and especially young chefs have probably heard this from older chefs and they go, yeah, whatever. But at the end of the day, it's not, we need to be able to decipher what's professional cooking and what's a trade, because they're two very, very different things. And if we, until we want to go down that path or hold that conversation or put in times of apprenticeships and different styles of training to afford what goes into being a professional compared to a tradesman, well, then we'll always be going around in circles and having these conversations. So, you know, all the time I spent over in the Northern Hemisphere, you don't have someone, if someone was working like you do in a 2 or 3 star kitchen, in a gastronomic kitchen, if you're working like that in a bistro selling steak frites and escargot and, you know, all those classics and terrine and blah, blah, if you were working the same hours and the same days, well, that would be taking the piss. And everyone would know that. It's pretty clear what it is you're up for and where do you want to be at the end of this training. And I guess going back to some of the focus on the media around our profession and our industry over the last few years, I would challenge them to go into a bank, go into a law firm, go into a real estate agent, go into a shopping center. And if you get it and you go, if you go around those circles and talk to those people, you will find the same problem in all different platforms of work. So why is our industry in the limelight? I seen a story in the paper last year about Woolies, and it was a tiny little column 4 pages into the paper. Yet if it's a chef, they're on a headline on the front page of the newspaper, or they're getting chased down the street by a journalist. It doesn't make sense.
Yeah. So are you saying, like, perhaps there could be a shorter apprenticeship for someone who's into cooking as a trade, because, you know, they want to know they can always get a job, but they may only have the ambition to cook at I don't know, like at an institutional level?
I think so absolutely. Yeah. And if, you know, well, one hat doesn't fit all in this industry. It just doesn't. You know, I was talking to a young fellow that's working at a regional pub. He's doing over 60 odd hours a week, and they don't make anything. It's, you know, even, which is a shame, because good pub food can be fantastic if it's done well. But everything's bought in, everything's just heated and served and whatnot. So doing those hours, that is what I would call taking the piss, because what are you getting out of it? You're not getting anything. You're now servicing, you're being used to run that venue wholly and solely, and that's it. What's coming back to you for doing that extra work? So, but the decision process for young people to want to work more, to learn more, to have a career, a higher career, and be able to, decide what they want to do that 10 years down the track or 6 years or 8 years down the track, that's being taken away from a lot of good young people that do want to work. And that's where I get a little bit jaded with the old guard that, you know, he always bangs on about, oh, they're not like we used to be and they're soft and blah, blah. That's rubbish. I have a lot of fantastic young people through my team. But the issue is, which they'll be the first to say, the potential or the opportunity for them to devote themselves more to a craft, which it is a craft, has been taken away from them because I can't let them stay longer and do all that work. Is that fair? I would probably say not. So, and I guess that one hat fits all for cooking, which is decided by the powers that be. It's just wrong. And we lose good people from the industry all the time. And one thing that's important to note is that everybody should be on the same platform. So if you're a gastronomic chef and you work in a premium restaurant and you're doing artisan-style cooking, and that's great. You are no more important than somebody who is training hard to run a hospital in an institution or a nursing home. Look how poor the nursing food is in general throughout the industry. You're no more important than them, but they need to specialise in a different style of cooking. They need to specialise in dietary food, and they need to be a champion of that. So do you need to work 12 hours a day or 14 hours a day for 5 years to learn that? Probably not. It's a different style of training. So, and same for short order cooking in sporting clubs and RSLs and leagues clubs and cafes doing short order cooking and great breakfast style dishes and short order lunch meals. Again, should you be working 12 to 14 hours a day doing that? I would say no. And do you need to do a 5-year apprenticeship, or do you need to work 10 years straight to learn how to do that? No. So then why do we have one size fits all? If you want to be the executive chef of a 5-star hotel with 400 rooms, banqueting for 1,000 people, 9 different outlets, blah, blah, do you think you're going to be able to do that after 3 years? No chance. No chance. Not a hope in the world. So therefore, why is it a 3-year apprenticeship? It doesn't make any sense.
If someone wants to be the first violinist in a symphony orchestra, no one tells them to stop practicing.
Exactly right. Exactly right. 100%. And you know what? This system causes us to lose a lot of good people. And now we have kitchens and chefs championed on TV, and that's great. You know, I thought they were all mad wanting being on TV, looking at it, you know, from abroad. When I came home, I said I'd never do it. But in 2017, when we built the new Montrachet, going into 2018, I was approached by MasterChef to do a show. And I said to my wife, there's no way I'm doing it. I don't think I should do it. And but I'm a cookie boy, so I really just like being in the kitchen. So even after all the things we own and 130-odd staff, I like to spend most of my time in the kitchen. So, but my wife said, you know, people like you, you're going to be this old fuddy-duddy in years to come and be angry with everybody because no one cares or, you know, respects what you did and blah, blah. So now's your opportunity to show people what you can do, and maybe that'll inspire young people to want to be a chef. And when I thought of it that way, I thought, well, maybe that's a good point. So I went on, and I'm really glad I did, because I met an amazing group of amateur cooks that absolutely blew me away on how hard they could work. Absolutely blew me away. It was amazing. But what's their pathway into a professional kitchen? Other people watching that, that's what made me sort of retrospectively look back at it and think, well, if someone's looking at home now and I've inspired somebody to want to cook for a living, well, how do they know where they should start, going by their, you know, their mental stability, how strong they are, pressure can they handle? Well, who knows? Because, you know, we have to consider those things now to keep people in the long term. I think in any job, not just cooking, that seems to be the way of the world. So if they don't have pathways to choose with all the information laid out, they might aim too high. And after 6 months go, my God, I can't handle that, and they're out. So that person leaves the industry forever, but they could have been a champion at something else in the industry, but now we'll never know because they had a bad experience or they started off too high. Or didn't research enough, what is it going to take? They don't realise that if you work in a 2 or 3 hour restaurant, your pay is probably going to be worse than if you worked at a local leagues club, for sure.
Mm.
And no one tells them that, so they're not prepared for that. They don't know. You know, when I did my apprenticeship, I used to work out that I was, for my whole first year, I was on around $1 an hour.
Jeez.
And I wouldn't change it for the world because that wasn't what it was about. I've had a huge career because of that foundation, and that's what I worked for, and that's what I got because I worked for it.
Yeah, but there's just got to be different pathways now, doesn't there?
Yeah, there does, absolutely. And, yeah, I think so. But also customer expectation. You know, no one talks about that enough in the industry at all, because that hasn't changed, especially for that does flow into the kitchen quite a lot, but it also really flows onto the pressures of the front of house. So I'll put this to you. If you go to a Coles or a Woolworths now or a Bunnings or any other shops, you don't pay any less for your product, but you've got to check out yourself. If you go into a bank now, there's one teller, maybe two if you're lucky, and you're in the line for 20 minutes when you used to walk into a bank and straight out. Same with the post office, same with all general services, right? All the services have been cut, 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 and the prices have gone up and up and up and up and up. So in a restaurant, if you're 5 minutes late turning a table, people are in your face. If you're too late getting a meal out, people are in your face, and so on and so on and so on. So nothing's been – our industry, we can't dumb down what we do. The expectations are there, as they always have been, if not more, yet the labor cost is huge, and it's hard to work out how to dumb down what we deliver as far as service goes. So if you think of it that way, our industry is really, really difficult at the moment. For many reasons, for many reasons. It's not like, say, imagine if you come into Montrachet, a hatted restaurant, and I said, oh, I've had to, you know, reduce my wages by 20% and the payroll tax and the super and all the deferred payroll tax from last year, that all that's owed now. So we're paying double that. And, you know, all my new businesses didn't get any JobKeeper because they were new. So when we finished building all this facility here, we got shut down. We moved in February. So because all my business were new with 60 staff inside, I didn't get a cent of JobKeeper. Because it was a new business. It's just unbelievable. So, and then you look at big corporations using their strategies to, you know, to retain the JobKeeper and still getting the dividends and blah, blah. It's just mind-blowing. So, but we can't reduce our cost of wages. If I said I'll reduce, you know, wages by 20%, sorry, you need to come to the counter to order your meal, my restaurant would be shut within a week. So it's very hard to try and keep doing what we're doing, but keep up with the times as well, and also the costs.
Mm. So, okay, Shannon, so PM's on the phone and he wants you to fix hospitality, sort out this staffing problem that everybody's got. What can you tell him? What should be done?
Well, I guess if you look at what's a short-term fix, because training, changing the way, I guess, giving more resources to people for training, because training is expensive. And that's another thing, you know, without the chef owners, without many chef owners, I would really challenge people to walk into any kitchen or any restaurant and ask for a dollar figure on how much it costs to train someone. And I tell you that, and I guarantee you, a lot of them will look at you like a rabbit in headlights. Okay? It's true. So there's an issue right there. But if we're after a quick fix, I would probably say that we need skilled workers to come into the country immediately. So to give you an example, I have quite a few sponsored staff throughout all my businesses that specialize in certain areas, especially in the patisserie, for example, and also the artisan bread making. So, but they've been with me for some time. So as their sponsorships come to the end and they choose if they want to move around or they want to go back home, well, who am I going to replace them with? No one. The biggest risk that my business has right now is not having skilled staff to replace skilled staff that potentially will be leaving soon. That's my biggest fear right now. I don't know what I'm going to do. I just don't. But no matter what experience I've got, I don't have an answer for that. And it's we're certainly causing a lot of loss of sleep at night at the moment. So I would probably say that we need to get skilled workers in and create a special visa to get bakers and pastry chefs. And chefs are probably up there for some venues, and that's certainly to do with the current training situation over the last several years, how that's changed. But when it comes to specialty areas like patisserie and bakery, we're in all sorts. So I would suggest probably we certainly need a special visa set up. You know, I just read yesterday that there's a visa made for veterinary surgeons to bring them into the country because there's not enough vets. Well, I'll tell you what, if a chef got a vet's wage, they'd be probably in their canoes trying to get over here. So, you know, but look, yeah, I think, and I just think that we're not in, and no disrespect to vets, go for it. Good luck to them. And I'm sure they've been working hard. But when you see in the newspaper that a hard week, 60 hours, well, I'm sorry, but again, not in sync at all on what's going on in our industry for the people at the top. If I did 60 hours a week, I'd be bored.
What about a medium term or a longer term solution, Shannon?
Medium term, longer term solution, I think we need to really strip right back the RTO system and how the training is being done. I really think that medium term, I think assisting business owners to be able to do their own training in-house and afford. See, you got to look at it this way. There's a smaller pool of professionally trained people in our industry. So if they're relying on more than ever now to keep the businesses going, and all the pressure is dumped on them to keep it going, and certainly if you know, talking to people in the industry that are the highly skilled people, the pressure's all on them because they're the ones that know how to get through this and how to work harder, and they're taking on all the slack. So how are they ever going to train people? They're not. So there's less people with the required skills to train the younger people coming through. And on top of that, they're inundated at the moment. So they can't train anybody because they're getting flogged. So I would certainly say that the government need to give some grants to our hospitality businesses so they can get some more hands on deck. Where those hands are going to come from, who knows? I guess, you know, things like taking away the 20 hours a week for the students, I think that's been a massive help quickly. It certainly has been. But people need some more hands to take away the tedious tasks that are unskilled, like the cleaning and the vegetable prepping. And, you know, you can't have highly skilled people covering that and trying to run the business and trying to train people. It's just too much because the few professionals that are left in the industry now, they're all going to be burnt out as well. Some of them already are. So, the short term certainly is looking at getting skilled people into the country, get them quarantined, get them into people's businesses to help them take the trade. And, you know, the sad part about it is the trade's there. For a lot of people, the trade's there. And, like you look at the poor buggers down in Victoria that were shut for so long and so many venues, people staying internally in the country, it should be making up for all that lost ground of last year. And it's just another kick in the guts right now because they're shutting down on certain days because they haven't got enough people. Like, it's when you think about it that way, it's just phenomenal. I think that's certainly short term. Long term, I think we need to really look at how the RTO is being done and give people some resources so they can maybe look after training themselves in their own workplace.
Yeah. What about it being seen as an attractive industry in the first place, you know, that people were proud to go into hospitality? I mean, do you think that there's a cultural problem in Australia that hospitality jobs aren't as valued as they should be?
Absolutely. You know, there's a stigma around that in Australian culture, and there always will be. You know, I'm not a European saying this, so I'll say it open-heartedly. I'm an Aussie as they come. I'm fourth generation Australian. So, but I've travelled a little bit, so I see things in different perspectives. So, yes, for sure. Of course we do. I still get crap from my – I'm 44 years of age. I still get crap from my older brothers for wearing an apron. You know, it's just the way it is. And, you know, I take it with a laugh and a shrug, and that's okay. I'd rather wear an apron and stink like grease every day, but so that's okay. But and I think for a lot of people in Australian hospitality, you're really seen as – I'm not sure if there's a better word to use, but I'll say servant. So, you know, you're working unsociable hours, Friday nights, Saturday nights, working most nights, missing out on birthdays, missing out on family events, you know, almost being a little bit recluse. And who do you hang around? Who do you meet? Most, you know, I've barely met a chef from my generation that isn't married to a maitre d', a sommelier, a restaurateur, maybe the odd person in human resources, you know, if you're from a hotel, who knows, but where do you go and meet people? So, you know, that's the way it always used to be. So I think people have moved on from that now and they have a different expectation. So that makes it very difficult attracting people to the industry as well. Unless people want to change their eating habits and go out at daytime, you know, a few days a week and you're only open a couple of nights a week, but how are you going to fund the restaurant? So I, you know, all those things, certainly we have a different outlook on hospitality. Again, in general, there's some people that love hospitality and love that lifestyle, but it's not as common as what you would see in other countries, that's for sure.
Mm. Yeah. Well, why do you love it? Why are you still doing it, Shannon?
Oh, look, I think you need to be a little bit of a nutter to be a great chef. I think you need to be a little bit different to want to devote, certainly to the level that I have. And, you know, your family has to mould around that. And that's what I'm used to. That's what I've seen. I've worked with a lot of chef owners overseas. I've been in their kitchens, been mentored by a lot of them. And I guess from what I've always known since I started this at the age of 16 is that whoever the chef is of the family are all in. Doesn't mean they're all going to be a chef or work in that industry, but their lives certainly revolve around the person and the family, whether it's the mother or the father that does that for a living. Certainly everybody molds around that. And it's been the same for my kids. I've got three kids. One's 20, one is 12, one is 10. They're in the kitchen all the time. My oldest boy works with me full time. He plays sport. So he does all the dispatch every day at 5:30 and works. He works really hard. But he's grown up seeing how hard I've worked and commuting backward and forwards from overseas. They've just sort of seen that, and they've all had to grow up around it. And hospo kids are usually pretty mature and pretty self-sufficient. He had to, get himself to school, make his own lunches, iron his own uniform. He used to iron my uniform every day while I was home to learn how to iron properly from the age of 12. He was ironing my uniform every day, perfectly pressed. And if it wasn't done perfectly, he had to do it again. So I guess those standards and that work ethic, certainly your family has to mold around it. But that's, it's a rare thing. I guess it's a small percentage and even smaller now than what it used to be. So the kitchen for me used to be an oasis. I used to always think to myself, it's hard. And when I started, it was like, wow, it was bloody like full on and exhaustion. But the one thing I loved about it was that not one problem in life could bother me while I was inside that kitchen. No one was allowed in that kitchen. You weren't allowed to walk into a chef's kitchen, no matter who you were, what you did, what issue was outside, what family problem you got, whatever issues in society and life or whatever, no one can bother you when you're inside your kitchen. And again, I guess that might be a weird way of thinking, but I liked it when I was young. And that's why I just threw myself into it. And I love being in the kitchen. And I still do.
Wow, Shannon, I love it. It's so incredible to get your perspective and the benefit of all your years in the industry. I think it's really interesting how innovative you have found that you have to be, but you've certainly made the best of it. Got any final words for the Dirty Linen audience, who I'm sure are hanging on everything that you say?
Oh, look, I'd probably – final words? I just think – forget all the, forget all the. If you're thinking about getting into cooking, first of all, do your research on where you're going to work. Be committed. Practice a lot at home, and cook for people. If you love that, you need to find that. If you love cooking and you're passionate about it, you need to find that bridge of loving cooking, but also having a career, because they're two very different things. So you got to have a bridge that connects the two. And if you can find that, you're half a chance. That's probably the best thing I can finish off by saying.
Yep, very wise words. Shannon, thank you so much for taking the time to have a chat to us. Really appreciate it. Yeah, take care.
Thank you. You too. Bye for now.
This is Dirty Linen and I'm Danny Vallant. We air the issues that the hospitality industry finds hard to talk about. We spend a week thrashing around each issue, hearing from different people with unique perspectives. We want to hear from you as well. If you have something that needs to be said about a topic, get in touch so we can include your perspective. Contact us at dirtylinen@deepintheweeds.com.au or hit us up on Insta @dirtylinenpodcast. We can't wait to hear from you.